This is Stephanie.
And this is Brian.
Welcome to the making and the remaking of A Codependent Mind. This is going to be the final episode in season 5, Codependency Voices. We're excited about starting season 6 because we've been working on a special project.
Yes, we've been working on the book version of the podcast.
And we hope to have that available on Amazon by late March. So we're going to start season 6 with an introduction to that book. But meanwhile, this episode entitled Money Talks, we're going to dive into the financial side of codependency.
I mean, this kind of almost felt a little bit left out, sort of like how we left out sex. It's kind of a very important topic for a lot of people. Well, everyone to some extent. And, you know, I had quite a bit of shame about, unexplored shame, really, about my financial life, just like I did my sex life.
The topic came up a little bit. For instance, I think it was in the narcissism episode.
Season 1.
Yeah, a long time ago. I mean, just in terms of the financial abuse that you experienced in both your relationships, particularly with R, but with Jay to some extent as well, where the narcissistic control extended into finance. So we'll explore that again a little bit more, but we also just want to talk about your relationship to money and how the codependent habits informed that relationship as well and compromised you financially a number of points during your life, sometimes severely.
Right. Yeah, the codependent habits and the whole package, the emotional avoidance and everything, worked the same with, no surprise really, that it worked the same with finances as it did with everything else.
When we've talked about people-pleasing and codependency in general, we've talked about the ways in which people use what they have. So, for instance, to go back to people-pleasing, you know, some people are funny, some people are charming, some people are good caretakers. Your version of people-pleasing was kind of affability and compliance. Kind of whatever your strength was, you would kind of enlist those strengths in order to satisfy your codependent urges with other people. And for you, money was functioned in that way from very early on.
Yeah. I mean, I managed, despite my powerlessness and kind of lack of vision and agency, I just went into a very easy field, majored in college and got a job in it. I followed in my dad's footsteps. He didn't ask me to or anything, but I was just like, well, that looks fine. I'll do that. And that's basically how I came into my field. And then I just started doing it and slowly climbing the ladder, and things worked out fine in my career. So, you know, I've always had a stable job ever since I got out of college. I mean, I got laid off a couple times, but I was able to quickly get another one because of the field I'm in. So it was something that I always was able to offer.
Right from the beginning. So for instance, your 10-year friendship with E, that was a positive experience overall.
Right. The relationship.
The relationship was, yeah. But still was compromised by both his distorted behavior, but also by your distorted behavior, your codependent behavior. And there were financial components to that.
Yeah. Money was one of them. And we'll get to when it got worse with other people, but with him. So, you know, he had a dream to play music for a living. And I didn't really realize that wasn't really what I wanted to do, but I was like, that sounds like a good idea. I'll go all in on that. And basically, I just found myself caretaking with money year after year.
You were both in your early 20s. And as you mentioned, you had a job right out of college.
I had a job right out of college, right in my field. He couldn't get one in his field. And so he had to just kind of find jobs and sometimes struggle with that. A lot of times struggle with that. And sometimes it was because of his emotional or alcohol and things like that, that interfered with that. But I was just like, well, I have a job. I'll just pick up the slack. But even when it wasn't picking up the slack, it was going above and beyond in a way that he didn't ask for and actually made him, I think, feel uncomfortable, but he didn't know how to express that it made him feel uncomfortable, I think. For instance, we were going to do this music thing, and I was like, oh, well, we should have an extra bed. We should get an apartment with an extra bedroom so we can have a studio. And he's like, well, we can't afford that. And I was like, well, I mean, I can. He's like, well, but I can't. He's like, well, I'll pay more. You know, I'll just pay more. He's like, well, okay, I guess, you know, but he's trying to find ways to accommodate for that. Well, why don't you take the master bedroom? Why don't you take the parking spot? All that, you know, that kind of stuff, kind of a reasonable person would do if they were faced with that, probably. I mean, we had conversations about it, is the bottom line. You know, we had that kind of communication, that we were able to have honest communication about the financial situation, even though, you know, I was approaching it codependently.
You had communication in terms of how honest it was, maybe not so much.
Well, yeah, that's true.
You weren't aware of why you were insisting on this. And
right.
And as you said, it made him uncomfortable, possibly feel even some shame.
Yeah. I mean, that part, I was pretty clueless of. That's something I can kind of look at now and go, that probably didn't feel good. I mean, judging from what I remember his responses being in those accommodations, it was probably coming from that, yeah, a place of shame and a place of like, are you sure? And for me, I was probably just thinking, well, yeah, sure. As in, I'm only thinking of myself, because that's kind of what that went with my codependency, this self-centeredness. And I'm like, well, sure, it's fine. I don't know. I have the money anyway. It doesn't matter. Sure. And I'm not thinking about how it would make him feel to be constantly reminded every day that we're in a place that he couldn't afford. It reminds me of some of the other shortcomings, like when I would dismiss his emotional difficulties and stuff. Oh, everything will be fine. Don't worry about it.
So that is one example. And then there are kind of many in that relationship where, again, you were using money to try to keep the situation, which was increasingly unstable, in part because he was struggling emotionally and financially as well. And you would just throw money at the problem, essentially.
Yeah, and it is actually very similar to like him expressing an emotional distress and me going, don't worry about it, everything will be fine. I'm saying it with money.
I'll just pay for it.
Don't worry about it, yeah. And take as long as you need to get a job. I'll pay for stuff for now, you know, don't worry about it.
So again, using money as a form of people-pleasing and caretaking, as you mm-hmm. said, in somewhat of an inauthentic way, because you're not actually, what does he need? He doesn't need you to be paying his share of rent or getting him into apartments that he can't afford or buying him into a career that he wants. Like that's not your role.
Right. Well, and then it got even worse from there because I discovered credit cards and then started purchasing music equipment and stuff like that on credit cards and knowing that I wouldn't be able to pay it off. And then just started to build up thousands of dollars in credit card debt with this same kind of, and that's going to be something we talk about a little later, the emotional side of it. But I was compartmentalizing the money the same way I was compartmentalizing everything else during that friendship was just like, it'll be fine.
And when you say thousands of dollars of debt, it was actually tens of thousands.
Tens
of thousands of dollars of debt, which is where you were when you met R.
Yes. Yeah, I was still carrying quite a bit of that debt.
And she also came into the relationship with substantial debt. And not just substantial debt, but also the narcissistic sense of entitlement. So your codependency in that relationship was fully activated in a way that it wasn't in your relationship with E. So your financial codependency kind of went off the charts.
Right. I was already behaving codependently financially with E, but across the board, it was just in a more minor way. I wasn't being fully activated. But yeah, once I met R, there was the stuff we talked about a little bit in season one, where I moved in very quickly. I moved in within less than 2 months, I moved in with her and then started immediately paying for half of the rent and bills and all that kind of stuff. And then very shortly thereafter, her job just became unbearable. And I said, well, yeah, I guess you should quit, you know, like helped her into the decision, or she helped me help her into the decision mm-hmm. that she should quit her job and just get something else, just something part-time and low stress. And so then, yeah, at that point, I just went right back into kind of this full-on money caretaking mode, but it was totally different this time. There was an entitlement coming from R every step of the way. And I went right into combining our finances. So I like, you know, set up a budget and, okay, I'm taking on her debt now. So now I'm combining our debt and combining the finances and, okay, we just all the money that she makes, whatever, all the money I make go into one account and I'm just paying all the bills and keeping track of it all. And then she kind of just went hands off with it. But then at the same time was a crazy spender.
So she went hands off with keeping track of the money, but she was hands on with spending the money.
Yeah.
Which was at this point your money.
Mostly. Yeah. I mean, she worked, but I made substantially more. All of it should have been going to debt. I mean, this is part of the problem, right?
Over the course of that relationship, the debt balloons considerably.
Yes. So it went from already bad to extremely bad. The credit cards were maxed out for the entire marriage, the entire relationship. So from that point, when she quit her job and we combined our debts.
Which was only months from meeting
yes.
each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Within a couple months. Yeah. We carried this debt throughout the entire relationship. So would maybe make a $500 payment here and there, you know, if managed to not spend too much on just eating out and stuff like that, and then just immediately put it right back on.
So trips and eating out and, mm-hmm. I mean, all the things that kind of classically narcissists believe that they're entitled to.
Yeah, I mean, moving on a regular basis, which is really expensive to move, to have to pack up and every time it was this kind of grand move too, that was like you had to get rid of furniture and buy new furniture and things like that. And yeah, it was just a financial disaster from start to finish. And I wasn't listening to my emotions at all. I'm just like, well, this is depressing, but it's not depressing because I'm feeling powerless over this. It's depressing just because, man, I just can't seem to ever get out of debt.
Was it resentment as well?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I resented R about everything every day. Obviously, this is not something I was focused on and knew about at all because, yeah, I mean, it made me very angry / resentful because I couldn't do anything with my anger. I had this feeling that I would even at the time describe as our money. It was either our money or her money. I never felt as though I could ever even just like buy a shirt or something. I had zero financial freedom. And I kept trying to come up with these plans to pay off the debt, you know, let's pay it off in 5 years. And then it was always 5 years. It was just 5 years until the end of the relationship.
Because she'd have a new plan to move somewhere, to take a vacation or to buy a car.
Yeah. And oftentimes, I should say, of course, oftentimes I'm offering these things up because that's part of my codependent ways of being was because all throughout the relationship, I just, what do I need to do? So I know she wants these things and I know she wants unique life and unique things. And so whenever I could, it was an expectation that I was going to provide an interesting, exciting life. So I would come up with ideas too for trips. And
you would be shamed if you couldn't provide it. But you would also just feel shame.
Yeah. I mean, I would do the work. I mean, I think we've talked about this before. Like as the years go by, the direct, blatant, abusive behaviors kind of shift. It's like, okay, seems like he's got a handle on that one. I can kind of ease up on that one because he's doing it every day now. So I'm gonna lean into this new thread of abuse now. You know, it just kind of deepens. But yeah, finance was one that was all the way through.
So you kind of lucked out financially in that relationship, in that you were able to, during a different time, buy a house, mm-hmm. get a loan. Someone gave you a loan,
yeah,
you know, with your tens of $1,000s.
And terrible credit, yeah.
Terrible credit, buy a house, and then it increased in value. And around that time, she decided that the marriage was over. Probably not a coincidence that she was going to be able to get out of the marriage and out of the debt at the same time.
Yeah.
But you almost immediately, you do immediately enter into another financially codependent relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I probably would have continued to financially support her for years because she expressed wanting to be a business partner with me. And
you mean post-divorce even?
Yes, post-divorce. So it's like, okay, let's just end the sexual relationship basically, but I want to continue to have your financial resources. So she was trying to find ways to continue that happening. But she was using the same tactics, which was just abusive behavior, belittlement and condescension and scare tactics. And, you know, and the only reason why I didn't continue, I mean, I did continue in a large way. And
you threw a lot of money at
I did. Yeah. It was a very disproportionate divorce that I somehow magically called amicable.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, she wound up taking quite a bit of money and you know, I didn't divide the debt in half. I took a majority of it, even though I split the house proceeds 50-50. It was very bad, but it could have been much worse. I may have continued to support her for years to come if it weren't for Jay entering the picture and basically putting a stop to everything.
Right. Jay's like, no, you're not sending no, that. Money goes to me, not to her.
This is my money now.
So interesting. Clash of the narcissists.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
And the trajectory was very similar in the relationship with Jay. She was not quite the spender that R was.
No, yeah, yeah. I think it almost seemed like it was part of her persona to try to come off as someone that wasn't a spender, you know, like I buy all my clothes at Goodwill and things like this. And that's great. Cool. But it was very sneaky the way she would get me to spend money. And all told, really, I was almost in the same position.
Spending to your means, if not occasionally beyond them.
Right. I was able to get out of the rest of that debt, mostly just because I sold that house and then kind of just put my foot down for 6 months and got out of the rest of it. But then, yeah, beyond that, then I was living paycheck to paycheck again.
And similarly, we've talked about this before, Jay quit her job as well.
Within a similar time frame, within a few months of meeting.
Of meeting you.
Yeah, and moving in together, yeah. In a similar way, a very similar way, too. Just like, I can't tolerate this job. It's affecting my health. But with her, it was even more extreme. It was like her abuse, which I've described before, you know, this kind of rage, yelling at me and temper tantrums. But extreme, it was particularly bad in the beginning. And she blamed it on her job, you know, like, it makes me so tired. And, you know, so she was making excuses at that time. And the job was the excuse. But pretty much when she quit the job, the excuses stopped. So it's like the excuses were just a way to get out of the job.
Right.
And then I did the same thing. Combined the finances, took over everything. And yeah, she contributed even less in the long run than R did. Just at times, nothing. Just laid around and did absolutely nothing.
And there was still the eating out and the expensive vacations.
Mm-hmm.
And with her pretty significant spending on medical issues.
Health-related stuff, the kind of mysterious illness that she had. And she was always trying to get to the bottom of that and taking very expensive over-the-counter supplements for these that were hundreds of dollars a month. And, you know, buying things like a massage table and $7,000 hot tub and things like that, you know, to try to make her as comfortable as possible so that she wouldn't continue to be abusive. Because that was pretty much the game of that relationship. How do I avoid her being angry? Which she told me, I get angry when I'm hungry or tired. So make sure I'm not tired. So the whole sleeping thing where I couldn't move in the bed or she would get angry and swear and pound the bed and stuff. Yeah.
And again, money was a tool for you to do that.
Yeah.
Money was a way for you to caretake. Money was a way for you to manage the situation and the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for periods, I felt as though it was working. You know, I was just like, okay, good. That was a good purchase. That seemed to lower the, if you think about some meter where it's like in the red, you know, I lowered it a couple down towards the yellow or something with that purchase.
So these were the ways in which the financial codependency was expressed. But like you mentioned earlier, all the internal mechanisms were the same as with the other codependent behaviors. The compartmentalization, the rationalization, the telling stories to explain, the not looking at the big picture.
Yeah. I mean, so the stories were most commonly, well, it's similar to the stories I told about those terrible relationships in general, was just that I wanted this stuff too. Yeah, you know, like
I wanted a music career. I wanted an exciting life.
Yeah, I wanted this house that was way too big for two people. I wanted this trip that I could have. I didn't need a $10,000 trip, you know, somewhere. I just didn't need these things. But I was like, well, who wouldn't want that, you know? So it was very easy for me to convince myself that these were all things I wanted.
We found recently notes that you took.
Yeah.
From a book about money, about investing and retiring.
Yeah, right. I got these books near the end of the R relationship. Ironically, R gave me one of these books. I have no idea why she's... And I held on to and read them somewhere around the middle of the relationship with Jay. Because despite the fact that I didn't have a big picture at all of my life, I was hearing constantly, one being from my dad. Thank you, Dad, you know, for asking me pretty regularly, are you investing? Are you investing? Are you using your 401k for, you know, all this stuff? And I'm always like, no.
So we should say, at this point, you're in your mid-40s. You got out of the crippling debt again from selling a house, but you had zero invested for retirement.
Zero, yeah.
You were a good earner, as you said. You were in a career that pays reasonably well, but you had zero. No savings and right. Nothing invested for retirement. So there was shame there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There was shame and there was fear. Because the fear being, I know people are doing this. I know this is the only way to retire. You have to save money. And also the fact that every time something happened, like a car broke down or something, that I'm screwed. You know, I have to use a credit card. Just, it's not a good way to live. I mean, sometimes you have to, obviously. Like, it's different for everybody. But I didn't have to. I chose to. Chose in air quotes, like it's like the codependency choose. Because, you know, I chose to be in those relationships too, you know. But so, yeah, I knew I had a lot of shame about it and I had to rationalize, compartmentalize it. But I think the only reason why I read those books is because of my dad just continuing to ask me. And then it just would shame me every time. You know, he wasn't trying to shame me. He was just asking. And so for that reason, I started investing in my 401k, but just 1%, just to there, I'm doing it. And then I read these books and yeah, we saw these notes. It was interesting. First of all, I hate reading something I wrote from the past like that, because my language is just unbearable. For one, being like this, I was writing this about Jay and my financial position, and everything's in we.
As if you were financial partners.
Yeah, right. Even though it's just, it's all me. I'm just providing for this person. But it starts off just kind of, you know, okay, here's some notes, here's some things that I'm reading here. But then progressively, as you get through the notes, it becomes more and more powerless, more and more shame. And I start to swear a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting. You never swear.
Yeah, I don't.
So part of the notes were that you were to find this fiduciary being just a term for an investment advisor that mm-hmm. clears some regulatory hurdles. You're going to find this fiduciary, and early on in the notes, it's very hopeful, friendly tone to this fiduciary. This fiduciary is going to be your partner and going to explain these things that you're not very clear about and help you get your financial.
Yeah, so it's full of questions like, oh, I don't really understand this. I'll ask the fiduciary.
I'll ask the fiduciary and they'll help me. And then, yes, as it goes along and you start to realize kind of, I guess, how behind you are, you kind of feel the shame starting to ooze out from the page. And yeah, by the end, I mean, you just, this poor imaginary fiduciary, you're just like swearing at this guy, cursing him out because he dares to suggest that you shouldn't take this expensive vacation instead of putting some aside for savings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're dropping F-bombs to say like,
yeah. Well, because I'm saying like, what's the point of investing, you know, just putting all this money away that you maybe will get to use someday, you know, like you got to live for today.
Yeah. So we can just see those, the rationalization and the stories being just developing right there. So you see the shame and then following the shame immediately.
Yeah.
First of all, this resentment, the resentment that the fiduciary would challenge you.
The imaginary fiduciary. Yeah. The
imaginary right. fiduciary.
Yeah.
Would challenge your decisions. And then so resentment and then immediately rationalization, like, yeah, I got to live for today. You know, I may die before I retire.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just kind of telling these stories about your life as if this was a rational decision that you were making to eat out all the time rather than, you know, live within your budget.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that I'm just talking to myself here, you know, but then the major punchline, I think, to this whole thing was that once I got to the end, you could just see like I was done, like this whole thing, screw it.
That's, and then the compartmentalization comes in, because then it goes in a compartment and you had no memory of this.
I completely forgot that I even read these books and took these notes, and it was only a couple, maybe 3 years before we met. And I never brought it up with Jay. I just stayed the course, continued with my 1% 401k and basically put in my mind that I was never going to retire. That was what I took out of the whole thing.
And that's what you told me. So we meet again in your mid to late 40s, and you have very little retirement savings. and I ask you about it. I'm gonna work until I die. I'm kind of, well, it doesn't sound like a good plan. And you're doing what you did with R in terms of the divorce with Jay. You're throwing money at that divorce, hoping to manage the shame and fear that you had with that action.
Yeah, it was really, it felt like it was one of the only tools I had to, like, you know, because I was just, I was walking on eggshells. I was afraid constantly that I was going to do or say the wrong thing that was just going to blow everything up. And
you were convinced that if you kind of gave her some magical number in terms of money, that mm-hmm. this would all be fine and she would stop attacking you. She should stop guilting you and you would stop have to feel bad about leaving that relationship. So how did you recover?
Well, similar to how I recovered from codependency and everything in general, I met you.
Well, that wasn't a sufficient condition.
Yeah, I know.
Although I flipped through one of the books that you were talking about, you still had them when we met.
Yeah,
it was one that your dad had given you, and very early on, it said something to the effect of one of the most important financial decisions that you can make is the person that you marry.
Yeah, right.
Or whatever version of partnership.
Yeah.
I think none of us really think about that, or very few of us do, but it seems to be true.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. How much do you really know about the person that you're devoting your life to and how they are with money? And
exactly, because that's going to have a huge effect on your financial health over the course of your life.
Right.
So I was pretty financially healthy. I had substantial retirement savings. I had thought a lot about in my life about the role that I needed money to play. mm-hmm. and kind of made decisions based on that.
Yeah. And I remember you asking me some questions, and this was really early in our relationship before we even got to all the work on codependency and things like that. Yeah. You were always very good about asking me direct questions without it triggering my shame somehow. I don't know. It may have triggered it a little bit, but not so much that I just walked away and tried to leave the conversation. And I remember you asking me, like, yeah, like, when you're going to retire? And like I said, I'm never going to retire. And then we just started having these very basic conversations about, well, why is that? What, you know, how are you saving? Well, I'm not, because I'm just maxed out or whatever. And it's like, well, why are you maxed out? And it's just like, I didn't think about the little pieces that go in. It's very basic. The mortgage I was paying, I did not need to be paying a mortgage. I mean, that's one of the easiest ones to go to begin with. You know, it's just like, that doesn't take that long to break down. Because basically, one of the things I was saying in the notes was, how am I going to be able to afford this exact lifestyle? That's going to take a lot of retirement money and stuff. But why did I have to afford that exact lifestyle?
Right. Why did you need a 4-bedroom house when you were there was two of you?
Yeah. And so I didn't. And it not only did it not provide happiness, it did the opposite. It provided shame.
So this was the big picture thinking that you started to do. This is the breaking down the compartments.
Yep.
Although in breaking them down, there was shame.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, I'm uncovering the shame that I was avoiding all that time with the stories. And
so that was part of, like you were saying, the recovering from codependency, the recovering from financial codependency involved facing shame. And actual processing, rewriting the stories.
Yeah. And now that you mentioned this, I think this is maybe one of the earlier retelling of stories that I did, because really I started doing this kind of shame processing about my financial life before I got to any of the stuff we've talked about in this podcast. Somehow the facing the shame of my finances was just a little bit easier than the relationship shame or the sex shame and things like that.
I mean, that might have been a little bit because you did blame J&R to a great extent.
Oh, yeah.
Early on.
Sure. Yeah.
And as soon as you were out of a relationship in which that was being activated, you got control of your financial life pretty quickly.
Right. Yeah. I felt the momentum of that. Yeah. I got a studio apartment and I went much smaller and didn't eat out as much.
And immediately started saving and upping your 401k. Although it is interesting because you did, even early on, you did kind of do some financial codependent stuff with me. Mm-hmm. Like you were very quick to offer your financial resources to me and to treat it like I should have a say in major purchases that you're making.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It was a default for me. Yeah. Just like all the other codependent, you know, the people pleasing that I did, I just assumed I had to do that with everyone.
And then when we moved in together, you were ready, even though you made more money than I did, you were ready to take over a bigger portion. I had to be the one to say, well, no, you know, we should talk about what we both think is fair and what we both think is equal and, you know, what would happen if under certain scenarios.
Yeah, I remember very well that I had this spreadsheet that I created from the R days to pay down debt. And I used it and I called it my budget because, I mean, it was a budget for paying down debt, but I continued to use it as my daily tracking of finances.
Right. And this was kind of one way I thought, like, oh, I think we're kind of compatible financially because I've been very budget minded. But as you know, when eventually we did combine our finances, I realized, because you looked at this budget every day, and I realized, well, it's not actually even a budget. I mean, it's kind of funny, really, because you set it up in order to get out of debt. Well, you never got out of debt.
That's I not know. How you got out of debt. That was...
And the same thing with Jay, you were kind of like, oh, I mean, I think it gave you the sense that you had things under control when obviously you didn't at all.
Yeah, I didn't. It actually just made things more depressing. Like, I might as well have just not be tracking it at all. Because, yeah, I every day, like, going onto the credit card page and, like, pulling off all the expenses and putting it onto a spreadsheet, okay? Like, I'm just doing these, like, tasks.
It's interesting, too, because it was almost an Excel version of compartmentalization.
Yeah.
I mean, there were all these tabs, and there were all these places where you put stuff, and you had to put stuff over here, and you had to put stuff over here, and it all had to tie out.
Yeah, it took, like, an hour sometimes to tie it out.
Like, and it's just, you know, I just had this one, like, simple overview of this is generally where I spend in each of my categories, and you know, again, kind of with this big picture sense of where am I financially on a month-to-month basis or on a global basis. And you had none of that. There was none of it in your budget. There was nothing about what your assets were and if they were doing what you wanted them to do. And
Well, and you had an actual budget too. We're like, this is how much I'm allotting towards X, Y, and Z, and you tracked it throughout the month.
Yeah, and if it didn't happen, I thought about why it didn't happen, and I thought, well, how did that influence other categories? And
yeah, so mine was not a budget. I called it a budget, but it was a compartmentalization tracker.
So yeah, this again. So healing, if we kind of distill program, it's like one, you have to be, if you're in a partnership, it has to be a healthy financial partnership. There was quite a bit of facing shame, although not as severe in some other instances, and processing it and getting the actual truth of the story. You know, the ways in which I kind of pushed you on, like clearly, yes, both R and J were taking advantage of you financially, almost to the extent of financial abuse. But yet, what was your role in that?
And, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the last part, this being able to get a big picture of your life, which involved thinking about what do you want from your life?
Right. Which is a good thing to do no matter what. I mean, it's a good thing to do in your relationship, finances aside.
Right. Yeah. How does your relationship play in what you want from your life? But yeah. In terms of money, what role can money play in making that happen? Mm-hmm. What role should it play in making it happen? And the role that money was playing in your life, kind of in the same way that was playing in R and J's life, is just kind of trauma management, right?
Yes, yeah, right.
You're just trying to fill up holes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and ironically, it just because it's causing shame, it's doing the opposite. Like now I'm just adding all these layers of shame, making my trauma worse.
And again, once you were out of relationships that were really activating your codependent behavior, you seem to make that switch pretty easily to be able to think about like, oh, what I do want to retire I do value travel, but I don't need to eat out 5-6 times a week. You know, I enjoy cooking. I mean, you were just starting to be able to look at where you were spending money and decide if that made sense for who you were and what you valued.
Yeah. So I'd say now my relationship with money is integrated into the full picture of everything. You know, it's integrated into my emotional structure. It's into my view of myself and my life and my relationship. And none of that was integrated. Nothing about my life or myself was integrated. So my finances are integrated. And even if things are difficult, I know I have the capacity to handle it. And I have a partner that I can communicate with. And, you know, because when you talk about the importance of the partner, it's just that you are able to be on the same page and communicate about what you both want your shared money to do, what your shared finances.
I think at this point, money is fuel for living the life that you want rather than a strategy for managing a life that you didn't want.
Oh, that's good. That's a good way to think about it. Yeah, right.
I think this imaginary fiduciary who you felt was judging you, I think actually he would be very pleased with where you are right now.
I think so too. So that wraps up season 5.
And we hope you'll join us in a couple weeks. It may be 3 weeks. We'll see how.
Right. We're almost done with the book. We're not quite done.
Ready to go. Or if you're listening to this in the future, the book will be available on Amazon and you can search for it.
It's going to have the same exact title.
It's going to have the same title, The Making and the Remaking of a Codependent Mind. And thank you again, everyone, for listening.
Yeah. Thank you for all your feedback. And we've got such great comments and reviews, and it's just so happy to hear that people are getting a lot out of this podcast.
Really gratifying and totally useful, and hopefully that comes across in the book, everything we've learned from all of you.